Oh, church, when did we lose our way?
Welcome to the Deconstructionist Podcast. I'm your host, John Williamson, and welcome to part two of my interview with Sarah Hurwitz. In our last episode, Sarah shared her personal journey of rediscovering her Jewish heritage and how that shaped her latest book called As a Jew, Reclaiming Our Story from Those Who Blame, Shame, and Try to Erase Us. Today, we go even deeper, talking about the big questions the book raises, how ancient wisdom speaks to modern life, how rituals can ground us in an unsteady world, and how communities of faith might navigate the challenges of our time. Drawing on her experience as part of President Obama's speechwriting team and her years as Michelle Obama's chief speechwriter, Sarah brings both intellect and heart to these conversations, and I think you'll find the second half of our discussion just as inspiring and thought-provoking as the first. So let's jump back in. Thanks always for listening, and special love to my buddy Clay, otherwise known as Forrest Clay, for the special music you hear at the beginning and end of the episodes. You can find his music anywhere music is found, and the songs used are off of his EP called Recover. So check it out. So without further ado, I give you Sarah freaking Hurwitz.
Tell me what made us think.
So obviously, like right now, you've got some chapters on Israel, anti-Zionism, which is ironic because I just released on Monday an episode on the history of Zionism.
No way. So such great timing.
Yeah. So obviously, there's some problematic historical theology there on the Christian side, for sure. Now, I wanted to educate myself because I think a lot of folks are watching the news these days and we're seeing, you know, some pretty horrific images and hearing some pretty horrific things. And people are caught because on one sense, the whole thing started because of a terrorist attack on innocent people. And then the reaction has been equally as violent, you know. And so people don't really know. I think, A, they don't know the history.
Right.
Like, why are they even fighting? We just know as Christians in America, we're just told, like, you support Israel no matter what. And it's like, but we don't know, like, at least the younger generations don't know why. And so.
Right.
The episode I did on Monday was an attempt to sort of unpack that and say, here's the history. It comes out of this thing called dispensationalism and started by the same crackpot who tried to peddle the Left Behind nonsense.
Right.
The rapture did not catch on anywhere but America because we will literally buy anything. But there are reasons behind how we got to where we are. So anyway, how do you separate out critique of Israeli policy from anti-Semitism, and what lines are being crossed in the current climate?
Well, I love this question because it gets at something very deep that I think a lot of American Jews, including myself, are struggling with right now. Because, you know, I'm a Zionist. And what I mean by that is that I believe that Jews have a right to safety and security in a state in their ancestral homeland. You know, I believe Jews have a right to national independence and self-determination, just like Japanese people have in Japan and Latvians have in Latvia and people in countries across the globe have, right? You know, the founding of the Jewish state was not particularly unusual. It was founded the same way many states were founded back then, unfortunately, through war, bloodshed, partition, not great ways, but it's kind of a country, right? It was just founded like a country. And, you know, the reason I'm so passionately a Zionist is because we ran that experiment of Jewish statelessness for 2,000 years, and it did not go particularly well for us. Just in the 20th century alone, it wasn't just that 2/3 of Jews in Europe were killed in the Holocaust. It was also that, and many people don't know that, there were about 1 million Jews living in Arab lands until the mid-late 20th century, and 850,000 of them had to flee persecution in those lands. 650,000 of them went to Israel. There were also 2 million Jews living in Russia up until recent decades, and they were brutally persecuted there. They left, and 1 million of them went to Israel. There were also tens of thousands of Jews in Ethiopia who were being persecuted. They left and went to Israel. And so, you know, what you see is that for 2,000 years and even longer, Jews have been persecuted just about everywhere they've gone. And so this idea that, like, oh, we're all going to be fine, we don't need a state, it is just not true. Like, we've run this experiment. It did not go well. And at the same time, while I'm a Zionist, I look at the current Israeli government and the current Israeli leadership, and I am appalled. You know, I vehemently, strongly disagree with this current prime minister and with members of his coalition. I find their ideology appalling. I find, you know, what they are doing now in Gaza is just unacceptable. You know, I was, you know, originally when, obviously, when, you know, that massive terrorist attack on October 7th happened, of course, like any country, you have to protect yourself, you know, after not like this is what you do. This is what any country would do. But, you know, today it's very clear that this war should not be continuing. And so it's very hard. In a way, it reminds me of actually being American right now, where I am a passionate, patriotic American. I love this country so much and believe so deeply in it. And I am very deeply opposed to the current president. And, you know, I can hold both of those things. And where I think it draws crosses a boundary from critique to anti-Semitism is as follows. You know, to be clear, it's fine to criticize Israel. Welcome to the national pastime of the Israeli people. All they do is criticize their government all day long. Welcome to the national pastime of every American Jew I know. We are very, very critical. So, like, if you want to say, I just abhor and deplore this particular policy for these particular reasons, it's unacceptable, it's sickening, it's wrong, here's why, great, let's do that. Or if you want to say, I think that this is whatever you want to say for whatever reason, like, say it to me and we can have a conversation. But I think what I struggle with is, you know, I visited 27 college campuses after October 7th, and I spoke to Jewish students there. And what I was seeing on campus, it was not criticism, but it was more slurs and accusations. Things like Israelis are Nazis, or, you know, from water to water, Palestine shall be Arab. And, you know, God forbid that a Jewish student should ever say Palestinians are terrorists, or from water to water, Israel should be Jewish. I think we would both recognize that as racism, eliminationism, absolutely vile and despicable and unacceptable. And so, you know, I think there's a big difference between slurs, between accusations that you don't back up, and between real tough critiques that you actually back up with some facts and arguments. You know what? Let's have that. Let's have those critiques. Let's have that debate. But I think a line has kind of been crossed in some ways. And I think that's kind of a problem.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's sort of that dualistic thinking that often gets us into trouble, where it's everything is black or white and it takes the nuance completely out of it. And it's like, you can't just say, you never hear when there's an attack or another school shooting and we find out that that person was Christian. We don't demonize all Christians. That never happens.
Of course not. Right? That would be obscene. Right.
But God forbid that person was from the Middle East. You
oh,
know,
my
then
God.
It's
right.
All,
then it's the racism. It's the Islamophobia.
All Muslims are terrorists. You're like,
exactly.
Whoa, whoa, whoa.
So, right. And you're like, just this hateful, racist stuff. And I think what's particularly confusing right now is that so many people, including me a few years ago, we misunderstand what anti-Semitism is. We think it's just this personal prejudice. Like, oh, Jews are dirty, cheap, crass, gross. I don't want to be friends with a Jew. You don't really see that kind of anti-Semitism much anymore. But what you do see is a kind of political anti-Semitism that takes the form of whatever the worst thing in a society is, that's what the Jew is. It takes the form of we, the majority, are engaged in this grand moral project, and the only thing stopping us is the Jews. So we, the Christians, are Christianizing the Roman Empire. The only thing stopping us are the Jews. We, the communists, are bringing about the great revolution of brotherhood and the revolution of man. But the only thing stopping us, these capitalist Jews. In Germany, it was we, the racially pure Aryan fatherland. We are bringing about this wonderful Aryan nation. The only thing stopping us are these race polluting Jews. And today in America, you see it on the right, which is, you know, we white Christian Americans are bringing back white Christian civilization to America. And the only thing stopping us are these Jews who are importing black and brown immigrants to take the place of white Americans. Bonkers. It is a racist, anti-Semitic lie called the Great Replacement Theory. Absolutely. It's so vile. Like, even just saying it makes me sort of feel ill. But you see that a lot on the right. And on the left, you see we are doing the great moral project of anti-colonialism, anti-Semitism. The only thing stopping us are these colonial... I'm sorry. Let me take that again. On the left, you see it as we are doing this great moral project of anti-racism and anti-colonialism, and the only thing stopping us are these racist colonialist Zionists, which is kind of a polite way of saying Jews. And so, you know, you're seeing this on both sides of the spectrum, and it's confusing because anti-Semitism kind of gets upgrades. You know, the medieval Christian clergyman didn't think he was a bigot, right? When he was saying Jews killed Jesus, he had centuries worth of very sophisticated theology to back him up. And then a few centuries later, a classy European educated university professor or student or gentleman, you know, he would never say, oh, Jews killed Jesus. That was medieval superstitious nonsense. He would say Jews are racially inferior. And he had lots of science, quotation mark, science to back that up. And today, the problem isn't the Jews' religion or their race. It's their nation, right? Today, the problem is Zionism. And I think there's a form of anti-Semitism that is not what we usually learn about, right? We usually learn about the Holocaust. So Jews are bad. We kill them. Nothing they can do to be saved. But there is a kind of anti-Semitism that says Jews are bad, but there is something they can do to be saved. And that is they can disavow whatever it is about Jewish civilization that we find disgusting. So back in the day, it was convert to Christianity, reject Jewish religion, you're saved. my parents' and grandparents' generation, it was maybe change your last name, maybe get a nose job, stop being so, quote, Jewy, you know, be a little more, a little classier, a little WASPier, and then you can join our country club, then you're okay. And today you see this demand, especially on college campuses, of like, you know, you need to reject your connection to your ancestral homeland. You have to reject Zionism and then you're saved. And you sometimes see this like quasi-conversion narrative with these kids who are saying like, growing up, my rabbi told me Israel was awesome and great. And then I got to campus and I realized, no, it's a racist, colonialist endeavor. And I saw the light. I had an epiphany and I took anti-colonialism into my heart and I'm saved. I'm now an anti-Zionist. And their classmates are like, now you are saved. And it's just, it's like, guys, it's the same story, right? It's like this is just the same, it's the same thing. Like, get new material, man. Like, come on, I'm a little insulted, you know? Do better. But it is, it's sort of the same themes and tropes of Jews as diabolically powerful, you know, totally depraved and in a conspiracy to hurt you. And you're just seeing this kind of work its way through history.
Well, and the irony behind all of this is, you know, you've got American Christians who are like, you know, you stole this land and yet, you know, there's probably a Native American somewhere saying, yeah, and you stole ours.
I know, right? And when you actually study the history of Zionism, Jews came to Israel and bought, first of all, they're indigenous. There had been Jews there for thousands of years. But the Jews who fled persecution in Europe, the Middle East, elsewhere, they bought the land. Like up until 1948, they bought and paid for that land, right? So it's just even that part of the story isn't quite true. Now, since then, I have plenty of criticisms of what's happening, but I just think the founding of Israel, you know, it's been kind of repurposed into this like original sin when actually, no, Israel was founded kind of like every other country back then.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think one important thing to point out also is that, you know, it does have this huge religious significance to the Jewish people. And so like, let's just solve the whole problem in the middle.
Great. Let's do it. Let's do it.
Yeah. Like to pull a quote from the 90s, my older folks will know what I'm saying, but you know, can't we all just get along? You know, is there a way for folks to share land that has significance to multiple religions? Cause you've not only got the Jewish people living there, you've got Islam, you know, Muslim people living there, but you also have Palestinian Christians as well.
Yep.
And they all sort of have this claim. And so like, can we all share this, this whole.
Hey, football fans, Drew Brees here. Kroger Play and Owner's Box have teamed up for the next generation of daily fantasy sports. First-time players can get $25 in free entries, plus 250 fuel points. And you can score all season long with 2x the fuel points for every dollar spent to use at Kroger Fuel Centers. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
Void where prohibited. Eligibility restrictions apply. 18 plus in most eligible states, but age varies by jurisdiction. Offer is valid between 8/6/25 and 1/5/26. Terms apply. See full terms and conditions at ownersbox.com/footballfuelpointstc.
I mean, my answer is yes, right? Like there have been so many proposals throughout history for how this could be done. This is actually not an unsolvable problem.
Yeah.
It's just a matter of human will. And I think the problem that you see is you see, you know, spoilers, you know, like when they get close to a peace agreement in the 90s, you know, a Jew assassinated Yitzhak Rabin, who was the prime minister, who was, you know, pushing towards peace. Like you know, and then when, you know, they were getting very close to a peace agreement in 2000, you know, Arafat decided not to do it. And then suddenly you have the Second Intifada, which is just 5 years of bloody terrorism, Palestinian terrorism against Jews that really hardened a lot of Jews who thought like, well, forget it. You know, so you have these kind of events where like, you know, at some point, probably the majority of people would have just said like, okay, let's do this. But you have these kind of extremists and spoilers. And it is just, it's so depressing because like, it is such a solvable problem. And actually probably most reasonable people could sit down and agree and can say, okay, you know, we're going to put aside all our past history, all of our, you know, look, if you have an extreme view that says all the land is mine and there are extremists on both sides who are convinced of that, well, then you can't compromise. But if you can step away from that extremism and say, you know what? Yeah, emotionally, I feel like all this land is mine, but pragmatically, that's not going to work. So how do we split this up? And there are ways to do it. But man, we're so far away today. It's really hard.
It feels like we've never been further apart in terms of an actual solution at this point. And like, and I'm so convinced because I've seen this happen, you know, in much smaller ways, obviously. You know, the act of just sharing a meal, you know, with someone and sitting down and just having a conversation. It's like you're sitting there having a meal, your stomach's full, you feel great, and like that's not the time when arguments are happening. You know what I mean?
Right. And you know, it's funny. I actually showed my Israel chapters to people with very, very different perspectives, you know, including, you know, really quite different perspectives. And it was so helpful to me because they were all people of goodwill. They were all thoughtful people. And even when they disagreed with me, they were very clear. They're like, here's your problem. Here's why you're wrong. And they were often right. You know, I learned so much from that process. It really helped me deepen my own thinking and nuance my own thinking and make me realize where I was really missing something important. So I wish there were more of that in the world today.
Yeah, absolutely. Let me see. You're really good at getting to my next question already. I have to skip over some.
You're welcome.
Just make my job easier, you know? Oh my God. Okay. So you got all those. All right. Let me move on to the last of the questions here. So let's kind of circle back to your sort of rediscovery and your reclaiming of your faith. And so your rediscovery of Judaism reframed it not as like dogma, but as anthologies of argument, which I love.
Yeah.
And a way of life. How does that change the way you approach God spiritually or even like your daily routines?
Yeah, I mean, both. You know, first of all, growing up, when I mistakenly thought Judaism said that God was a man in the sky who controls everything and rewards and punishes us, you know, I didn't buy that. I still don't. And I just thought, okay, then I'm an atheist, right? Or maybe I'm agnostic if I'm feeling generous. But, you know, I look at when I actually started studying Jewish tradition, we don't do dogma or creed. You know, you have endless concepts of the divine in Judaism. You know, you have ancient rabbis who in one breath are insisting that the divine is just wildly transcendent beyond all time and space and human imagination. And then the next breath, they're like, oh, no, God's your friend. You talk to God. God loves you. It's like both those things can't be true, but they just kind of rolled onward. Like, that's okay. And I think, you know, I look at Jewish mystics who say that God is everything. You're God, I'm God. The idea that there's any barrier or separation between us, that's an illusion, which means that actually that man on the street who is struggling and who asked you to spare a dollar, like, that man is God. You know, it's a very profound way of thinking. You know, there's Martin Buber, a Jewish philosopher, who says that God is what arises between two people in deep human relation, each seeing the other's fullest humanity, each being fully vulnerable to the other in those moments of profound human connection. What arises between those people is God. Also quite profound. You know, Mordechai Kaplan, who's an American rabbi, who said God is the process by which we each become our highest and truest selves, the process by which, you know, the acorn becomes the oak tree, by which we grow and develop. Again, none of these are a man in the sky. And so to me, these much more, you know, much less dogmatic and much more humble ideas of God, the sense of like, okay, wait a second, we're not going to shrink this down to something like a being, you know, they really opened me up to kind of a felt sense of divinity that even talking about it cheapens it. The minute you say the words, you kind of create an idol. So I find it really hard to talk about, but I do feel it in moments. And I think, you know, studying Jewish law has very much just transformed how I conduct my daily life, because like, you study something as straightforward as the laws of gossip in Judaism. And it contemplates a situation where, like, let's say we're colleagues and we get into a fight and I'm just so mad at you. And I go home and I call three friends. And I'm like, John is the worst. I think he's so sketchy. He's rude. He doesn't work hard. I just trash you because I'm so mad. I get it off my chest. The next day we come back into work and we realize it was a misunderstanding and we apologize. We make up. Here's the problem. I just told three people about you, and maybe they each told a few people who each told a few people who each told a few people. And so now, you know, maybe a month from now, you apply for a job at a company where maybe one of those people happens to work and they're like, ooh, I heard some things about that guy. I'm just not sure. Maybe a few months later, someone tries to set you up, you know, and like, oh, there's this lovely guy, you know, you should go on a date with him. It's like, oh, actually, I heard some stuff about that guy, right? In a moment of just venting, I may have really ruined your reputation, done some real harm to you. And there's actually a story about a man like from hundreds of years ago where a man went around his little town in Eastern Europe trashing the rabbi. And then he felt bad. So he went to the rabbi, said what he'd done, and he said, I apologize. Can you forgive me? And the rabbi said, sure, of course. But I just need you to do one thing first. I need you to take this pillow, this feather pillow, rip it open and scatter the feathers to the winds. And the guy's like, weird, but okay. So he does it, scatters the feathers to the winds, comes back and says, okay, am I forgiven? And the rabbi says, definitely. You just need to go and gather up all those feathers first. And, you know, it's a pretty profound image. How many of us have put those feathers out into the world? Right? That's one teeny tiny little piece of Jewish wisdom. I'll also say, you know, there is this old canard that Rabbi Shai Held spoke about on your show, this idea that like Christianity is a religion of love and Judaism is a religion of law. But when you actually study Jewish law, the very quote and nitpicky nature of it actually is setting a very high bar for love. So you have this very specific law that says if you go into a store and you have no intention of buying anything, don't ask the shopkeeper for the price of an item because you're just wasting their time and getting their hopes up. There's another law that says if you've loaned money to someone who's really financially struggling, and a couple of weeks later you happen to see them coming down the street towards you, you should actually try to avoid running into them, because if you do, if you know they still can't pay you back, you're going to embarrass them, right? You're going to stress them out. Now, you could say, like, come on. You can't just say treat workers well and help the poor. What you need, these little nitpicky specific scenarios. But what Jewish law is trying to do with these hyper-specific scenarios is they're really trying to inculcate in you an exquisite sensitivity to the needs and dignity and humanity and specificity of every single person that crosses your path. They're really trying to get you to see that particular person. It's kind of like being at the eye doctor, where they click the little vision machine sharper and sharper. And I think it's really the opposite of a lot of thinking that I see today, you know, especially in more progressive spaces, where it's like, no. There are two big crude categories. You know, oppressor, oppressed, powerless, powerful, and we hate and love them accordingly, end of story. And that's like clicking the vision machine backwards. So you just have two big blurry blobs and you can't even see them all that clearly. So, you know, again, that sensibility of Jewish law, like, that definitely shapes how I walk in the world. The feather story totally freaked me out. I mean, it just was like, oh my God, how many times have I done that? You know, it's really, once you can't really unhear that one. So there's a lot more like that in Jewish tradition.
That's sort of how I describe, like, when we're debating like a literal versus a metaphorical hell. And I lean more towards the metaphorical, you know, in the sense that, like, we create all the hell we could possibly ever need here on earth. And I always talked about it similar to the feather analogy. I talk about it in terms of ripples. On water, I can cause good ripples or negative ripples. Yes. And I have that ability because I have free choice every day. And I can go out and I can create ripples that affect people I'll never even meet. You know?
Yes.
Or I can go out there and try to engage in, you know, the divine spark that's within all of us. I really believe that, like, when we are with no strings attached, exhibiting acts of love towards one another, that's where we get a glimpse of the divine in those moments.
Absolutely.
Get that taste in it. And
yes,
like,
I know exactly what you mean.
You made me think of this really great Christian mystic, Father Richard Rohr.
Of course.
He said something it was one of the interviews that we did with him way back when that will always stick with me to the day I die. He said something about the fact that he was talking about how love is, like, we're made to love one another. You know, that is what we're made to do. And love being an action, it's not something that you can just selfishly hold on to, because then it's gone. It dissipates.
Right.
So in order to keep that love alive, you have to constantly be in the act of giving it away. And I'm like,
that is really stunning. That's a beautiful, beautiful idea. I love that.
He's
I
like,
love that.
Somebody can give you love and you can't just hang on to it indefinitely. Right. You have to then give that to someone else. And I'm like, oh,
that is really gorgeous.
Yeah. So one of the things you kind of brought up earlier, I wanted to touch back on is you've said here all along was a love letter to Judaism. And as a Jew is something different, more of a manifesto.
Yeah.
So in your personal intertestamental period, as it were, what shifted for you between those two books?
Yeah. You know, it's funny. What shifted was just, it was first of all doing this chaplaincy training and realizing kind of how much my thoughts about Judaism had just been shaped by growing up in a Christian country. But even more significantly, you know, I visited a college campus probably a year before October 7th, and I was speaking to the Jewish students at the campus Hillel, and this young woman raises her hand after I've done my whole thing about how inspiring Judaism is and la la. And she said, "So how did you deal with anti-Semitism when you were in college?" And I literally responded, "What?" Like, I actually didn't understand the question, because I went to college in the 90s. And my answer to her was, I didn't. Never, not once, not a single time, ever. And the kids looked so stunned. Like, it was almost like they didn't believe me. And then they started telling stories about the anti-Semitism they'd faced on campus. And I just thought, like, whoa, wait a second. Like, something is up here, right? You know, I was very aware of the kind of anti-Semitism of, like, the Charlottesville, the kind of right-wing anti-Semitism. Like, I was very aware of that, you know, the Tree of Life synagogue shooting in Pittsburgh, you know, in 2016 and 2017 and 18. And now I was seeing something on the other side of the political spectrum, which is my side of the political spectrum. And I just thought, something is up here. And so I started visiting, you know, with scheduled visits to college campuses. And I really began to kind of think about historic anti-Semitism. I took this deep dive through history and began to realize, like, oh my gosh, my Jewish identity has been so shaped by anti-Judaism, anti-Semitism, and by Jews' very understandable attempt to escape this persecution by assimilating and erasing ourselves. And I thought, like, we've got to strip away all of these layers of internalized anti-Semitism and shame and self-hatred in order to reclaim our tradition on our own terms. October 7th happened a year after I started writing my book. And people kept asking, like, oh, does this change your book? And I said, no, this proves my book. Actually, this is literally exactly what I've been writing about. And, you know, it's been quite a 2 years since then. You know, it's been, I think, you know, the last 80 years have been this kind of aberration in Jewish history for Jews, with both the existence of Israel and with this experience in America where Jews have been, you know, there has been anti-Semitism, but nothing compared to other periods in history. We've been so welcome in this country. And we've just had such a great run here. And I think it's a little jarring to kind of return to some of the things that my grandparents were dealing with. You know, I visited Israel soon after October 7th, and I was talking to this young Israeli man who had lost his brother on October 7th. And I remember just thinking, like, huh, he thought he was an Israeli. He thought he was an Israeli. And I thought I was like an American of the Jewish faith. But I think we're still both Jews. Like, I think in some ways we haven't totally escaped history. And so I think that's been kind of a sobering realization. You know, I kind of wish I wish my grandmother were still alive so I could be like, Bubby, how did you guys deal with this back in the day? Bubby is the Yiddish word for grandmother. And Yiddish is a language that used to be spoken in Europe and still spoken by a few older folks today.
Yeah. Yeah. I went to a liberal arts college in Bexley, Ohio, uh-huh. just a suburb outside of Columbus here. And it has a massive Jewish population. And there's literally the football stadium is like right here. And like right behind it is this massive, beautiful synagogue, right behind it.
So perfect for football games, you know?
Yeah. They were not real happy about that.
I'm sure. A little noisy, but that's okay.
Yeah. It's,
hey,
only,
it's America,
only
man. You know, it's like.
Right. Exactly. It's only a couple Saturdays, you know, during the year. It'll be all right. So for your last question, because I realize we're running short on time here. So
no problem.
I think a great place to end is, what does it look like for Jews and for allies to reclaim our story today?
A beautiful question. You know, there's oftentimes, you know, I hear a lot from Jews today, if we just had the right tweet, like if we just had the right PR campaign, we could fight anti-Semitism. We could do it. We're just screwing up. Like it's our fault. We're not getting it right. And, you know, just with all due respect and love, like there are 16 million Jews with an M. Okay. That is the size of the fifth largest city in China. We're a Chinese city. Okay. And there are 8 billion other people in the world. So the idea that we are going to control what other people think is a very, shockingly, it's not really working. We can try, but it's not really working. You know, instead of trying to bail out this flood, this tsunami with buckets, it's a good idea to focus energy on building an ark to weather the storm. And to me, the ark is becoming really deep, engaged, proud, practicing, learned Jews and sharing that tradition with others, showing others what does it mean to be a Jew? Like, you know, being open, being inclusive, but really being deeply rooted in your tradition. And I think for allies, and I know there are many of them out there, and I'm so grateful to them. I love every single one of you. You know, I think that, you know, learning about Jewish tradition, learning about Jewish history, I think can be very helpful because it can put into context a lot of what is happening today. You know, and I think just like, you know, just being there for your Jewish friends, just saying, hey, I know this is hard. I got you. Like just a little text can help sometimes, an email just to let them know, like, I see you, you know, you're not alone in this. And so many amazing friends have done this for me. And I feel such incredible gratitude for that. It really is. It's a great gift. So it's a pleasure.
Well, thank you so much. Book is amazing. Folks, go ahead and get it. As a Jew, is it out now?
It is out at September 9th. It comes out, but you can pre-order it whenever you want.
Perfect. So literal days away from the release of the book. So go check it out. Obviously, I will have everything in the show notes. So go check out the prior book as well, Here All Along. And again, thank you so much. I can see why you were such a good speechwriter.
Thank you so much.
Here's to hoping we get some civility back in government at some point.
From your lips to God's ears, as my people say. Lord knows we need it. It's a tough moment.
It's exhausting, I think.
Yes, it is. And conversations like this are such an antidote, right? Such a balm for the soul to just have these moments of learning, of curiosity, of open-heartedness. It's really like I've learned so much just from this podcast, from your other podcasts. It's really, I so appreciate what you're doing.
Oh, well, thank you. I really appreciate it. And again, thanks for coming on and sharing some of your time.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Does God have a faith? Does he have a body or even a name? If he does he know that I'm alive? Is God even here? Does she care that I doubt? Does she care that I fear? Something tells me God will survive. So take a breath. His face must look like yours. Did God kill his kid? Did he have to have blood before he would forgive? Maybe we made a God. Looks like us. Does God know my name? Is the ache in my soul just confined to my brain? Even so, does that mean it's not real? So take a breath. Face must look like yours. A face like a Tina, an Ahmed or Mildred, a Russ and his husband, Gus and their children. A face like a Kim, a Ted or Tyrone, a Lucy born with an extra chromosome, a Pablo with legs he can't move by himself, a girl born a Daniel who now is Danielle, a Bill agent, even white guys named Todd. If you have a heartbeat, you are the face. Look, if God